Welcome to the Friday Night Clive podcast with me, Clive Payne. In this podcast, we look back at the amazing charities, organisations and people we have chatted to over the past few months, all of whom have interesting and important stories to tell. Right, the Midlands Air Ambulance, that's a charity that operates 3 air ambulance helicopters and 2 critical care cars that serve the communities of 6 Midlands counties, constituting the largest ambulance operating region in the UK, and that's quite staggering. Each year it costs in excess of £9 million to maintain the 3 aircraft, with each ambulance mission costing an average of £2,500. A price worth paying, of course, to save lives, but how does the charity raise the much-needed funds? On the line now to talk to me more about the charity and its most recent and forthcoming fundraising endeavours is Helen Stevens, who's the Communications and Marketing Manager. Good evening, Helen.
Good evening, Clive.
Thank you very much for joining me. When was the Midlands Air Ambulance set up as a charity?
So we actually launched from Hagley Hall back on the 21st of May 1991. So we're about to come up to our 29th anniversary, and of course plans are underway for our 30th year, which is taking place next year.
What gave rise for the charity to be set up? Because obviously that's quite recent in relative terms, isn't it?
It is, yes. Well, actually, we're the third air ambulance in the UK to have been set up, the first of which was down in Devon after a lady unfortunately lost her son in a road traffic collision. And it was sort of highlighted that if he'd have got to hospital sooner, then they could have done something for him. And fair play to her, she then put wheels in motion and got people talking and set up an air ambulance with a helicopter there. A few years later, I think it was 3 years later, we had set up. And at the time when we were first launched, we had one helicopter chained to a tree in an airfield. And the crew airbase was an old caravan. Mm-hmm. So we've come a very long way since then.
Sure. Tell me about the charity's mission then, and how do you go about achieving that?
Yeah, and it's slightly changed over the years. People might be familiar with the term the golden hour, mm-hmm. which is getting people to hospital in that all-important first hour.
Yes.
Well, it's moved on from that, and it's now about delivering the definitive care that people need, actually, at that incident scene. So the clinicians are doctors and critical care paramedics who are trained to master's degree level. So they take on an enormous amount of responsibility and training, and they can now do procedures that previously and even up to 3 years ago wasn't even thought about in the pre-hospital environment. And now we're able to perform things like anaesthesia, hate to say it, amputations, other procedures such as what they call a thoracostomy, which is where they open up the chest and do open heart surgery. Mm-hmm. And that could be at a roadside with some very interesting sort of setup and dynamics. So we have to work really closely with the other emergency services to give the patient the best possible chance.
So really, the aircraft, it's almost like having a mini flying hospital then.
It is. And it's very tight and compact, actually, in the aircraft itself. So they tend to do as much of the procedures on the ground as possible and package the person for transport. Because if you think about it, from the waist down, once they're in the helicopter, it's very difficult to reach a leg or sort of a pelvis area. So they tend to do as much as they possibly can in the safest possible environment they've got, and then be able to airlift people to the most convenient hospital for their injuries. So, for example, the Queen Elizabeth Hospital would be a fantastic place to take someone who's suffering with any heart troubles or with burns, because they've got specific setup for patients with those injuries. Whereas a more local hospital, such as Russell's Hall, perhaps, would take somebody who has maybe been a hill walker that's had a fall, and it's due to the remote location that we're called out rather than the severity of their injuries.
Sure. Now, clearly the aircrafts are very complex vehicles. Give me an example of the kind of kit that they carry, because as we've just said, there's an awful lot that your people can do.
Yes, and they couldn't do it without the like you say, the equipment on board. I mean, as is the way, anything to do with a helicopter becomes 10 times the price. So even I still find it amazing that you still get a windscreen wiper on an air ambulance helicopter if it's raining. But of course, the windscreen wipers are slightly more expensive than the ones we're used to on our cars. But in terms of the medical equipment, they have ventilators, which obviously we're all very aware of right now. Mm-hmm. And although we're not specifically tasked to any coronavirus incidents. You know, the crew are attending to people that might well be in self-isolation because they're assuming that they might have it, and then they have a fall. We're going to a lot of incidents in the home where people are having falls and doing DIY accident and having accidents. So they are taking equipment out that and personal protective equipment that they might need now, which is new. There are other devices such as something called an oxylog, which helps to, and a syringe driver, which helps to fuse the medicines together so that they're offering the highest level of medicines that people might need. Again, like we were saying before, that we, you know, people will be given in hospital, but we're giving in the pre-hospital environment. And so the devices that they take out with them are fantastic for supporting them. And then looking at the cars, it's a one-person crew on the two cars that we have. And so if they're going to somebody with a cardiac arrest, they have a device that actually does the chest compressions so that the clinician can look at drawing up the right medicines while this wonderful device is actually doing some of the hard work with the CPR.
That's really clever stuff, isn't it? I mean, do the cars work? I mean, I don't mean like that, but what I'm saying is how do they differ logistically from the aircraft?
We have not in our area, but we had been asked, do the rotors pop out the top of the cars? And we had to explain to said person that no, these aren't helicopters in disguise; they are actually cars. So
it's not chitty bang bang.
But it was no. To be fair, that would be an amazing idea, wouldn't it, for an April Fool's or something?
Yeah.
So we've had the helicopters for obviously the 29 years. The cars are a really relatively new entity for us. And we found that in Birmingham in the Black Country and secondly Worcester, there are, because they're more densely populated areas, there are more populated areas of people having cardiac arrests, heart attacks, strokes, respiratory problems, so what we would call medical emergencies rather than trauma related. And because it's all about how the clinicians on board and the equipment and the medicines that they deliver is the important part, the mode of transport actually is in a densely populated area is better by car. So we were very lucky to have a grant from a grant-giving trust called the Help Appeal that has helped us to purchase these two cars. They're BMW X5s, and they are kitted out with the exact same kit and equipment and medicines as the helicopters are. So it is like taking the helicopter and putting it on wheels on the road.
And that helps from a resourcing point of view, because if you have somebody that perhaps works in the aircraft more than the car and then comes onto the car, they're not thrown by the fact that there may be any difference in equipment, because clearly it assimilates what the aircraft has, and that the idea is that technician would be able to almost hit the ground running, I guess.
Yeah, exactly that. Even to the point where the life pack bags that they carry have been compartmentalised so that they've all got certain sections in every single bag, so they know exactly where each piece of equipment is. And, you know, it might sound silly to say it shaves minutes off a job, but actually those minutes are crucial if somebody's in a really critical condition.
Yeah, I bet they are.
So they've really, really sort of looked at the efficiency of how we operate.
You mentioned coronavirus earlier on, and clearly we can't escape it at the moment, but should you be dispatched to a coronavirus incident, what infrastructure do you have existing that would enable you to meet the demands of that patient and their needs?
Yeah, I mean, like I say, it's unlikely that we would be directly tasked because somebody's got coronavirus. That's something that we are working with the ambulance service to support, and some of our clinicians are now working in the 999 call centre just up the road in Briley Hill and offering advice to people. But like I say, if we happen to go out to somebody that then looks like they're presenting, it is a case of we follow procedure, we put the team don their PPE, and it's a high level of PPE, so it's sort of the full boiler suit with breathing apparatus, which if you can imagine, you know, you've now put a face mask on and it's got air blowing into it that's purified air. Mm-hmm. They're then having to deal with not being able to hear each other particularly well, because it's like having a hairdryer in the back of your head. Mm-hmm. So it makes the jobs particularly difficult, but as they've all said, when we've spoken to the team, that you just get on with it, you make do, we've learned how to read one another if needs be. So there have been a couple of instances where they have donned the full PPE, typically in the beautiful sunshine over the bank holiday weekend. Amazingly, they just get on with their jobs and take them to the QE and make sure that the obviously the transfer of the patient is well handled with the team on the receiving end.
Now, obviously, all this has to be funded by donations and things like that. So your most recent fundraising endeavour, that's the Bike for Life event. Although this year it's turning virtual, isn't it? Tell me about that.
Yes, so it was due to be our wonderfully big, and it's the biggest event that we run in the year. It attracts 10,000 people, not just motorbikers, but families to the festival, people lining bridges to come and wave them on across the M54. So we were all geared up, pardon the pun, and then, of course, we had to postpone it, which was, you know, to begin with a difficult decision, and then, of course, it became very obvious that it was never going to happen this year. And we all thought, you know, we're not going to let the coronavirus ruin our fun, so we're going to do something to mark the day. We didn't just want to see it. Yeah, we didn't want to see it just disappear. So we thought, what can we do to keep the sort of the spirits up? And so we thought, we'll do a virtual ride out. So everybody that has taken part and has bought their tickets, we've asked to then send us a photograph of themselves with their bike, either at home or from, you know, a previous experience that they've had with their bike where they've been out and about. And then we're going to turn that into a really great video that will have a flag waver waving us all on. We'll have our VIPs taking part, which is Neil Hodgson and James Witten, Carl Fogarty, and all the regular crew that help us out. And obviously our local lads, the emergency bikers, Mark and Steve. And then, of course, the cavalcade will take off and we'll show the series of photos and videos on the 26th of April, which is the day that the Bike for Life would have taken place, and that'll be on our Bike for Life Facebook page.
Super. I mean, it's even the fact that it's virtual, it sounds a lot of fun. How much does it normally raise, you know, in
yeah,
past years?
And actually, I must say, when we had to postpone it, if you imagine there are 3,000 people that had bought tickets and not a single negative comment amongst them, everybody was so supportive. So I just wanted to say, if anybody who's listening has bought a ticket, thank you so much for your support. We were actually really overwhelmed at the charity by the level of generosity of people saying, you know, I'll keep the ticket till next time, or I'll donate it, I'll buy another ticket. That was incredible. So we can't thank the biking community enough for that support.
That's really good to know.
It was lovely. I mean, there were lots of tears. It's been a very emotional few weeks for everybody, hasn't it? But it certainly, you know, put smiles on our faces at that moment. But yeah, usually the Bike for Life event raises, last year was £82,000, which is enormous for us. And to equate, if we look at it in terms of sort of the missions that we go to, it would have been about 250 missions across our three helicopters and the two critical care cars. And that's, we're looking at probably a month's worth of missions. And that's sort of, you know, just to bring us back down to Earth.
And that demonstrates how costly it is to run the service, and why it's important to get, you know, donations and support from people as well, to literally keep things in the air. Again, dodgy pun there, but you know what
is.
I mean.
And demand, you know, despite the social distancing, the fact that we've been told to keep off the roads, we actually still got tasked to 17 incidents just over the August bank holiday weekend. Easter holiday weekend. Hmm. As, you know, many of those were road traffic collisions, people out and about. It was really hard to sort of see the stats coming in and thinking, oh, if people had just stayed at home, or if they just weren't out and about in that particular moment, would that incident have happened? And you can't be for sure, but you know, demand for our service doesn't stop, no matter what's going on in the world. So you know, knowing that our fundraising income is likely to drop significantly this year, just because people can't attend events or host them in our honour, or you know, our fundraising team can't go out and about and support the community with their fundraising. So it's going to be a very, very challenging year for us.
Sure. So give me an idea now how people can get involved if they want to take part in the virtual Bike for Life event. What should we do?
Yeah, so really, really easy. Either go to our Facebook page, which is Bike for Life Fest, and it's four as in the number four, so facebook.com/bikeforlifefest, or simply email a picture to us at bikeforlife@midlandsairambulance.com, and then anybody that sends something in will be included in the video, and we'll also put them into the draw to receive the goodie bag that we would have given to people who had entered anyway. So we're still keeping as much of the event up as we possibly can.
Super. Are you able to let me into a secret as to what's in the goodie bag?
So there's some sought-after merchandise around Bike for Life. We only ever do a limited amount of merch just because we keep it to the annual and then it's a collector's item. And then the kind people at the Motorcycle Live event have said whenever their next event is on, they will offer us free tickets for a lucky pair to go along to Motorcycle Live at the NEC. So whether it happens this year or not is, you know, I haven't got my crystal ball with me just yet. But whenever it does happen, it's a really cool biker event. So that will hopefully be welcomed by whoever wins it. And the way to enter is literally just sending the photo in. There's no more anything needed than that. But obviously we do look out for some more creative photos. We've had a few with people with signs and what have you, which have caught our eye. So they're definitely doing well.
Good. There are other ways that people can fundraise for the charity and donate to you, isn't there?
Yes, there are. So we've quickly changed from what's been very much a face-to-face interactive way of fundraising, and we're making sure that we're calling a lot of our vulnerable and elderly supporters and volunteers at the moment. And so it isn't just about people supporting us, it's also about us supporting our communities. That's what we're there for. So we have been sort of out there virtually, and some Zoom meetings are being planned with our lovely volunteers, but at the moment obviously we're having to take everything online, and so if people can donate to us via our website at midlandsairambulance.com, they can either donate one-off. It doesn't have to be a huge amount. Everything's adding up, and we are so grateful for anybody to even think about us at this point in time. Or they could play our lottery, and then there's a chance to win £1,000 every week, which, unfortunately, because I work for the charity, I can't take part in, but it does look like a good initiative, so I'm encouraging everybody else around me to do it at the moment.
I think it's also important to point out that even if somebody just donates a few pounds, you can actually do a lot with a few pounds, because if everybody does that, it compounds, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I always use the analogy of, you know, we have 9,000 collection tins in and around the six counties we cover, and people put change in when they're at the shop, at the corner shop, wherever they are. And, you know, if you think, oh, how's that going to help, you know, fundraise for a charity that needs to, you know, do £2,500 a mission? But actually, all of the pennies and pounds that go into those pots raise £350,000 a year, which is incredible.
Isn't it just?
So, and that pays for the fuel across all three helicopters each year. So it's, you know, like you say, every single pound makes a big difference to us.
So if anybody wants any more information, just recap how they can get in touch with you.
Lovely. Well, we welcome anybody to check out our Facebook page, Midlands Air Ambulance. We've got a virtual quiz next Friday, which should be good fun on Friday night. Or they can visit our website at midlandsairambulance.com.
That's super. Helen Stevens from Midlands Air Ambulance Charity, thank you very much for talking to Friday Night Clive.
Thank you, Clive.
You are listening to the Friday Night Clive podcast. If you like what you are hearing, don't forget to subscribe to get the latest instalment at blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. Now, on with this week's episode. National Sharers Story Month is an annual celebration of the power of storytelling and story sharing, providing a fantastic opportunity to fulfil the core aim of the Federation by bringing children and stories together. Never has this been more important at the present time, and Tricia is on the line now. Hello, Tricia.
Hello.
Thank you very much for joining me. First of all, tell me, what is the Federation of Children's Book Groups?
We're a national federation of individual local book groups, all set in different areas of the country. There's quite a few around the Black Country. I'm based in the Northamptonshire group. There are groups more or less all over the country and up into Scotland, and not many in Wales. But we cover the whole country, and our idea is that we want to bring children and books together. Now, that can be actual physical books, or it can be making sure that children can meet authors and illustrators. They all motivate children to read more, and reading is such a vital skill.
Absolutely. And in fact, I've just been looking, I don't know if you perhaps heard me say beforehand, but I've just been looking at The Guardian, and they have they've done some research, and I think there's clearly more Brits have taken to books during the lockdown, but they conducted a survey from the Reading Agency of more than 2,000 people in the UK and found that 31% were reading more since the lockdown began, with a particular spike of 45% among young people aged between 18 and 24. Now, I would imagine it's probably reasonable to say that most 18 to 24-year-olds, you won't get them to get their head in the book usually.
Not usually. They're usually involved with college courses, university courses, starting their adult life, whatever. They tend to be a bit busy. So it's an awful situation, but it's great that they're rediscovering reading.
Absolutely.
And I think, you know, the fact that perhaps they were readers as children, they've now gone back to reading. Is it such a... it gives you an... I'm trying to find the right word. It enlivens you. It takes you out of yourself. It
yes.
takes you away from whatever you're worrying about at the moment. And I think this is one of the great joys of reading.
I think also it's important to have a relationship with the characters in the book that you're reading, obviously, if it's a fiction
totally.
Book,
yes.
In order to get inside their minds and understand their lives, I suppose.
They always say that you shouldn't judge a person until you've walked a mile in their shoes. And I think books are a great way of walking more than a mile in somebody else's shoes, because you can put yourself into their lifestyle, into their problems, into everything else that goes on in their lives that probably is miles from anything you've ever done in your own life. And you're absolutely empathising with what they are doing and how they are living their lives. It makes such a difference to be able to read
to
relate to people.
Yes. Tell me about the aims then, Tricia, of the Federation of Children's Books Group.
Well, as I say, it's all about getting kids children and books together. Our main strapline, if you like, is bringing children and books together, and that's absolutely what we're about. Each group is individual. They all do things differently, but the Federation creates an umbrella organisation that helps bring them all together. We run a national conference. We encourage groups with things like National Share a Story Month and with National Non-Fiction Month, because a lot of people like to read non-fiction, not just fiction.
Mm.
So, you know, we try and celebrate both sides of the picture. And we also are there to bring events and authors and publishers and children all together so that they actually get a motivation to go on and think about other things and think about reading. In a much wider context than perhaps they would normally do.
Mm.
I mean, what one tends to find is that as a parent, you give the children the books you enjoyed as a child,
yes.
which is fine, it's great, that's a fantastic thing to do, and don't stop doing it. But also children need to find other books for themselves, and that can be done through book groups that meet in libraries, in schools, in all sorts of different venues. I mean, our local group actually tends to do a lot of just book recommendations and book reading lists, which help people sort of discover things they've never thought of before.
Sure. How many book groups are there, Tricia, in the UK? Do you know?
I think there are something about 26. It's very difficult to give you an exact number.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
They keep forming, and trying to keep a track on them all is quite difficult. But I think there are about 26 all over the country.
Does it matter that we read electronic books, or are we better off reading paper books? Because I'm old school, so I like the paper books, but I would have thought there's no harm in reading an electronic book as long as you don't tire your eyes out.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's about getting the right screen if you're reading electronic books. I've just done a couple of book reviews of books that, because of the current situation, I could only get PDFs of, so I was reading them on my laptop screen.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that quite a strain on my eyes.
Yeah.
But having said that, if you've got a different device, it can be equally as easy as reading a paper book.
Yes.
It depends what you prefer. I mean, I think it's quite interesting that a lot of young people read digitally, either on their phones or their iPads or whatever device they have, and then they actually go out and buy the book afterwards because they've enjoyed it so much they want to keep it.
Yes.
And I think that's a really interesting development which nobody had thought would happen.
I think as well, when one reads from an electronic device, when you look at a screen, one's eyes don't blink, and yeah, that's the one way you tire your eyes out. But I think when reading from a paper book, the eye processes the information differently. Now, you mentioned...
It does, absolutely.
You mentioned...
And it's interesting,
sorry.
There was some research done a couple of years ago
mm-hmm.
that actually reading from a physical book You found that you remembered, there's a physical memory about where something is written on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So that it actually becomes that sort of physical memory, whereas if you're reading off a digital device, you don't have that physical memory in the same way, which I think is fascinating, that our brain works in such a different way.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. Now, you've touched on National Share a Story Month. Tell me more about that.
Well, every year we choose a theme. We try and be topical. And this year, as it was the 50th Earth Day this year, which is a fascinating thing to celebrate, you know, the 50th celebration of Earth Day, we thought we would actually have the planet we share, which turned out to be sort of a bit sort of prescient, I suppose, because, you know, with this current coronavirus issue, it's just shown what a small planet we share and how we really do have to look after it and look after how we deal with how we live on this planet. And I think, you know, we didn't mean it to be that prescient. We really didn't. We wanted it to just be a celebration of books about the environment and about different peoples and how we could live together. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think it's turned out to be even more relevant than perhaps it might have been.
Yes, I mean, what are your key reflections of that so far, and what sort of feedback have you had?
Well, the official month doesn't start until May, but what's happened this year, because of the coronavirus and people not being able to actually have their group meetings and things, we've put the materials up in the hope that people are using them in home education settings. Now, we haven't had a lot of feedback from people about that yet, and I'm hoping that we'll get that feedback when people think, right, we'll enter this wonderful competition we've got where children can write a 500-word essay about our home and then win a wonderful author visit for their school. So we're sort of hoping that that's when we're going to get the feedback, perhaps a bit later in May.
That sounds
good.
But
at the moment, it's very quiet. It's quite difficult.
Yes, of course. Now, obviously, you've told me about the theme, and you were saying earlier on you've reviewed a couple of books recently. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading a rather wonderful Arthurian legend, but with a really fascinating twist. It's very definitely for young adults, and it's the characters in it are very gender fluid. So it's set in the future and the past. So it's a wonderful thing. It's crumbs! Can I remember the title? The Sword.
It'll come to you. We'll come back to it. Don't worry.
It'll come back to
it
me.
Will.
It'll come back to
yes.
me. In fact, I think I've got a photo on my phone, which I'm just trying to get up.
When
The Sword in the Stars.
Right. And who's that by?
And it's a really fascinating twist on the Arthurian legends, which I adore. And I love fantasy as well, so this is a really good book for me to read. But I read very widely across all sorts of things.
What sort of...
Mainly, I suppose, teenage books, but when I do read adult books, I like all sorts of things, from Kate Atkinson to thrillers to almost anything. And my favourite novelist is Charles Dickens.
Oh, undoubtedly. Undoubtedly.
So, you know, I would say I've got a wide taste, let's put it that way.
Sure. I mean, what sort of books should parents or those who have responsibility for young children, let's say from, between 5 and 11 years of age, what sort of things can they sort of look and focus on with their children?
I think the thing, it's a difficult one because parents feel that they want to give children books that will be educational and that will do them good and will stretch them in terms of their reading. But actually, what I feel personally is that the child who chooses their own book will read that better than any book that is given to them.
Why?
If they have that agency in being able to choose what they want to read, either from a library, which I know is difficult at the moment, or from a bookshop, or from browsing on the internet, or whatever, they will read that and get more from it than if they had been given a book and told, read this.
Why does that happen?
I think it's just that it's something we've chosen, we ourselves chosen to do, so therefore we get more enjoyment out of it. And you often find that children will read a book that is what you would think older than their age, but that they actually really enjoy because they've chosen it. It's a huge thing. I don't know what it is about this agency, about having, being able to choose your own reading. I mean, you know, it's like us. We like to choose our own reading. We wouldn't want to read necessarily something that someone else has said, here, read this, would we?
No.
It's exactly the same for children.
When I was little, it was my mum that really taught me how to read, and she was very good at it. And thankfully, I'm sort of, you know, quite literate when it comes to things like that. And I was made to read to her, and I also liked her to read to me. And even now, sometimes I'll go to bed and I'll put an audio book on. And I'll just lie in bed and listen to that. Or there are, you know, radio stations that will do things, you know, like a book at bedtime and what have you. But I like to be read to. It sounds daft at the age of 53, but I do like to be read to. So why
should... I've got a few years on you and I still like reading, being read to. It is such a delight to have somebody else read a book to you.
Yes.
And especially if they're good at voices, but they don't have to be, you know.
No, that's right.
It's just such a delight to have that interaction with somebody else. I think it really is important. And this is what reading for pleasure is all about, being read to, being able to talk about what's being read to you, and also being able to read yourself and then talk about that afterwards.
Yes. So why is sharing a story out loud important then? What are the benefits of that?
I think it's just the joining together of people all in one experience. It's much like going to an orchestral concert or a pop concert and having a really wonderful time because you're all enjoying whatever's happening on the stage. It's that in microcosm. It's actually being part of an event and all being in it together, and then experiencing all those same emotions and watching the same pictures, as it were, on if you're looking at a picture book or whatever, and then sharing what your thoughts are. It is that joint enterprise, I think.
Yes, yeah. Now, your organisation has a competition. Tell me about that. What's that all about?
We've got the wonderful author Amber Lee Dodds, who writes fascinating books for children sort of in the 9 to 12, 13 bracket.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've heard of her.
And we are asking children to write up to 500 words, doesn't have to be 500 words, but up to 500 words, about our home, the theme of home. It can be anybody's home, your own home, somebody else's home, an animal's home, whatever, just a home, and expressing that in this sort of essay, poem, whatever. And we've got a team of judges who are going to look at all the entries, and then we'll make a short list from those entries, and they will be judged. The final entry will be judged by Amber herself. Mm-hmm. And then the school that the child is at who wins the competition will get a visit from Amber for a whole day, which is a fantastic
prize.
Because it's usually very expensive to have an author for a whole day in a school.
Yes. So are there any notable people on the judging panel, any authors or people of note that we've heard of?
Probably not. There's just
You've got a panel of experts.
From the Federation.
Yes.
All of whom have been working with and interacting with children and children's books for many years, so have a lot of experience. But we're by no means household names, I'm afraid.
No. So how do we get our competition entries into you?
They can be emailed in any format that is likely to be read on any computer by nssm@fcbg.org.uk by noon on the 30th of June.
Right, just read that to me again, Tricia, if you will, but slowly. I haven't got my glasses on.
Yeah, nssm@fcbg.org.uk.
Lovely.
By 12 noon on the 30th of June.
So it's
so we're hoping
noon.
To have lots and lots of entries so that we can have a wonderful competition. And there's lots of other prizes of books and all sorts of things. So, I mean, it's not just the winner. There are prizes sort of for all age groups and I won't say all entries. We haven't got that many prizes, but we have got quite a lot.
Yeah, oh, that sounds brilliant. What have things been like for you with this current lockdown? Because you said, you know, you can't go out to the library and select books or go to a bookshop and buy things. So how has this affected the Federation and the individual groups that you've got?
It's affecting us quite dramatically, really. I mean, you know, we would all have been having regular meetings. We'd have all been meeting up with our members and talking and chatting, and of course we can't do that.
So no.
It's very much down to virtual communication and sending out newsletters and reading lists to people in the hope that if they've got children at home that they're trying to entertain and educate, that some of these things will be useful to them. It's really very difficult as a small organisation like us.
Mm. So, if I mean, you know, for us here in the Black Country, if we want to find a local book group to join in with, what is the best way of doing that?
There could be some run by libraries when they're open.
Mm-hmm.
Don't ever overlook libraries. They run some great events and great book groups and things like that. But you can find the list of current groups for our own federation on our website,
right,
which is fcbg.org.uk, like the end of that email address.
Yes, lovely.
And it's there's a list of all the groups, and you click on the link for which is your nearest group, and it gives you contact details for the person you need to contact to find out what's happening and what the group is doing.
Brilliant. Finally, I mean, are you aware that National Share a Story Month has grown and has been adopted by some charities for people to share their stories?
Not specifically. In what way?
There's a number of charities, particularly, I'll just name one. I don't want to name all of them because that would perhaps be unfair, but pancreatic cancer, for example, they've got a section in the news part of their website where it says, "What is National Share a Story Month?"
Oh, wow.
And also Macmillan, Community Macmillan as well. They have, in one of their blogs, they've got a section relating to National Share a Story Month, particularly about the value of stories. I mean, those are two charities I've just picked at random. Well, that's what my producer's given me, but I think there are a lot more. So it would be unfair of me to name, you know, any more than that. But yes, it is being adopted, which I think is really good.
Well, that's fantastic, because that's what we wanted to happen. You know, that's when we set the whole thing up some years ago, that's really what we wanted to happen. So that is fantastic to hear that it's really growing, because obviously, as the organizer, I only sort of get contact from the people who take part in groups or in schools and this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But that's fantastic that it's grown, you know, it's being adopted all over the place. That's wonderful. I'm delighted. And stories are so important no matter where you are in life.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know, I've learned such a lot. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. That's Tricia Adams from the Federation of Children's Book Groups. Thank you very much, Tricia, for talking to Friday Night Clive.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been really enjoyable.
That's your lot for this episode. You can catch the show live every Friday night on Black Country Radio from 8 p.m. If you love our podcast, please subscribe by heading to blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts from. See you very soon. This is a Black Country Radio podcast, presented by Clive Payne, production by Andy Caddick and Alex Griffiths.